Sports. Please welcome special guests, Mayor Julian Castro and your Vice President, Joe Biden.
Educated in a small town, taught to fear Jesus in a small town. Used to daydream in that small town, another boring romantic as me. But I've seen it all in a small town, had myself a ball in a small town. Met an L.A. dollar brought to this small town, that small town just like me. So I cannot forget from what it is that I come from. And I think people love me. Yeah, I can be myself.
Ladies and gentlemen, please remain standing for the Pledge of Allegiance by Iowa Army National Guard veteran and 4th Congressional District candidate, James Maurer.
Thank you very much. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Please remain standing for our national anthem performed by Sydney Lett of Des Moines.
Ooh, say, can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly we hail at the twilight's last gleaming, whose broad stripes and bright stars through the perilous fight, o'er the ramparts we watched were so gallantly streaming, and the rocket's red glare, the bombs bursting in air, gave proof through the night that our flag was still there. Oh, say, does that star-spangled banner yet wave o'er the land of the free, in the home of the
Please welcome to the podium, let's hear it for Ruth Harkin.
Thank you. Thank you very much, and welcome to the 36th Harkin Steak Fry. We are so honored today to have Vice President Biden and Mayor Castro join us. Our family and the Bidens go way back, and we share many family values. As you know, when the Vice President was a senator, he took the train home every night to be with his family. Now, that says a lot about who he is. Then there's Mayor Castro. Wow! Many of us heard his speech and heard him speak for the first time last year at the Democratic Convention. Wow, wasn't he extraordinary? And then to find out, he has a twin running for Congress. So he and his congressman brother are rising stars and definitely what our party is all about. You know, I've been thinking about our first fries in the early 70s. These were modest events. We would climb up a little hill on Joni and Gary Kiernan's farm in Madison County. steaks were $2. We always had cold beer. But guess what? We had a rule that there would be no political speeches. Can you imagine? We just gathered, drank beer, talked politics. And I recall the first event having less than 50 people. But you know, it was kind of fun. So we have just kept on doing it. No tweeting, no texting or Facebook posting. You had to be there. Then Tom began to invite guests who spoke. And we moved to the Mueller Farm, a bigger space, started having larger crowds, and up the price of the steak. And by 1987, the event featured candidates running for the presidency. Paul Simon, Dick Gephardt, Al Gore Sr., representing his son Al, were all among them. In 1991, Tom announced for president at the steak fry on Mueller's farm. Actually, that was one of our best ones. In 1992, candidate Bill Clinton was the guest. And he came back in 1996 as our president. So the Harkin Steak Fry over the years has become a real tradition. Rain or shine, we've been in mud, wind, cold, and some very hot weather. A couple of people have even told me they got engaged at a steak fry. Through the years, the constant has been Tom, fighting for us, for equal rights, working people, education, and health care. And most of all, fighting for people with disabilities. Last month, Tom and I were in Ethiopia, and we visited a clinic run by members of our Peace Corps. Among other things, they were working with disabled children, making wheelchairs and helping fashion limbs. I can tell you they were pretty excited to meet Tom, the guy who started it all, the father of the Americans for Disabilities Act. His impact has been felt here in Iowa, all over the country, and all over the globe. And it's been really wonderful to witness firsthand the efforts of his good legislation. But I have also been a witness to Tom's personal life, as you know. He has been a wonderful husband for 45 years, a terrific parent, and a doting grandparent. So please welcome a wonderful, wonderful senator who hasn't forgotten his first steak fry, Tom Harkin.
All right, everybody. Thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you all very, very much. Welcome. 36 Harkin Steak Fry, you heard it right. 36 steak fry, and we haven't fried a steak yet. I don't know where the heck that name ever came from. But as you just heard, I have an even better record, a better winning streak. 45 years of love and partnership with a wonderful woman by the name of Ruth Harkin. So I thank you, Ruth, for those kind words, a very formidable introduction by a formidable woman, former Story County Attorney, the only woman county attorney in the state of Iowa at that time, and the only Democrat in the Story County Courthouse. I ran for Congress that year. I lost. Ruth won. As I said, she was the only Democrat in the courthouse, the only woman prosecuting attorney in the state of Iowa. So I ran 2 years later for Congress, and more than once I heard it said that, well, if she's that good, he can't be that bad. So I wrote her skirt tails into office. And then Ruth became the Deputy General Counsel at the Department of Agriculture, appointed by President Jimmy Carter. And then she became the President and CEO of the Overseas Private Investment Corporation, appointed by President Clinton. And then a senior attorney with one of our nation's top law firms, Akin Gump, which was headed by our former Democratic National Chairman, Bob Strauss, and for whom both Julian Castro and Joaquin Castro worked in that same law firm also. And then Ruth went into the private sector, became senior vice president for one of our largest manufacturers, United Technologies Corporation. And through it all, a great mom to our two daughters, and now a wonderful grandmom to our three grandchildren. And I remember one time, some years ago, our oldest daughter, Amy, she was studying French in high school. And so she coined a phrase that has stuck with us ever since when she described her mother, Ruth. She called her La Petite Générale. Those of you who don't know, that means the little general. Okay, you got it. A very special welcome to the Vice President of the United States, Joe Biden. Now, folks, I got to tell you, I have enormous respect for the office of the Vice President. Every time I see the Vice President, I refer to him and address him as Mr. Vice President. But having known Joe for so many years and knowing the down-to-earth kind of guy he is, it's just hard not to call him Joe. So, Mr. Vice President, no disrespect, but to everyone here and to all of us here in Iowa, you're our friend, Joe Biden. And you're right. It's just Joey. That's right. Exactly. And he wouldn't have it any other way, I can tell you that. He wouldn't have it any other way. Well, I thank you all for putting up with the extra security today. I mean, in addition... All right. I guess in addition to the Secret Service and everybody checking tickets and the Secret Service doing their security checks, I heard that Donald Trump was outside checking birth certificates. So it is always a big deal to have the Vice President here with us. It's also a big deal to have San Antonio Mayor Julian Castro with us today. And if you'll just turn a little bit, I'll introduce his brother, Congressman Joaquin Castro, who is right back here with us today, too. Joaquin. So I'll tell you, our two speakers today really embody the strength and the genius and the heart of our Democratic Party. Mayor Castro is young, charismatic, one of our bright stars, with new ideas, new energy, broadening the constituency of our party. Vice President Biden, who embodies the enormous experience and wisdom and sound judgment of our party, which we need in these perilous times. We need both the new and the seasoned. And this is a great strength that we have as Democrats, and it's such an honor to have both of you here with us today. So, folks, every year the steak fry kind of marks the change of the seasons. It's a good thing that fall is nearly here. It's been a scary summer here in Iowa. Think about it. There was an attack on the butter cow. Isn't anything sacred anymore? Over the summer, we've endured visits by Rick Santorum, Rand Paul, Ted Cruz, Governor Oops Perry is on his way. All I can say, folks, is the clown car is filling up pretty rapidly early in the season. On a more serious note, a couple of weeks ago, Iowans celebrated the 50th anniversary of Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech. We all remember King's vision of justice for all of God's children. But earlier in the summer, Congressman Steve King made headlines with a very different vision, bad-mouthing children of immigrants who aspire to become citizens. Let me say this loudly and clearly. I am the proud child of an immigrant mother, and I know which King speaks for me and the rest of Iowans. It's not Steve King. It's Martin Luther King Jr. who speaks for us. Folks, Congress is back in session after 5 weeks of an August break. I want to say this. I have a couple things I just want to say. Yesterday the announcement came through that Russia and the U.S. had reached an agreement to dismantle, to secure and dismantle the chemical weapons in Syria by 2014. This happened because of the strength, the wisdom, the courage of President Obama. This guy right here, Vice President Joe Biden. And our great Secretary of State, John Kerry. We reached this agreement with the international community to secure them, dismantle them by 2014, and we didn't lose one American life. That's leadership, folks. That's leadership. That's leadership. And once again now, Republicans are threatening to shut down the government or default on the debt unless we dismantle Obamacare. Well, as the chair of the Senate Health Committee, one of the principal authors of the Affordable Care Act, I don't know whether to laugh or cry at that. Republicans have now voted 40 times to repeal the Affordable Care Act. 40 times. Now, folks, the good news for these Republicans is that obsessive compulsive disorder is covered under Obamacare. The even better news is that the Affordable Care Act is already working for all Americans. And next month, as you know, we start our sign-up. We're ending the denial of coverage based on pre-existing conditions for all children. Now, everyone by January the 1st. It's outlawing abuses by insurance companies such as canceling your policy if you get cancer. It's allowing young people to stay under parents' policies until they're age 26. It's providing for prevention and wellness programs for all Americans. In just 16 days, on October 1st, millions of Americans will be able to sign up on the exchanges for subsidized health care. At long last, every American will have access to a quality, affordable health insurance that cannot be taken away. And I want you to know that that will include every American with a disability. No more segregation, no more exclusion, no more second-class citizen for people with disabilities in America. So, Bruce, I understand that that they're probably going to vote again on trying to end Obamacare. They're going to fail. And they're going to fail at what they're up to because they're on the wrong side of history. Americans aren't going to allow Republicans to drag us backward, not on Social Security, not on Medicare, not on Obamacare, and not on opening new opportunities for our young people with disabilities all across this country. So we're going forward. We're going to forward. We're going to build a reformed health care system that works not just for the healthy and the wealthy, but for all Americans. Now, before I go any further, I want to acknowledge some special people. First of all, for, well, not all the steak fries, for just about all of them, my dear friend Joy Milligan has been our deaf interpreter at almost every one of our steak fries. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Joy. And was Susan here, too, Sergeant Hardane? Susan Hardane, right? Yeah, Susan. Let's hear it for Susan also. They kind of trade off. Boy, didn't that Sydney Lett do a great job of singing that national anthem? Sydney, well, I don't know where she is, but thank you very much. The grounds crew spent days setting up for today's event. Don Brown and Bill Brown and Don Ruby and Lee Thielman, John Kaiser, Jerry Ullman, Don Van Ryswick. Our grillers, again, Ted and Joan Lewis, Glenn Perry, Larry Gittins, Ted and Valerie Deal, Don and Dolores Van Ryswick. Again, let's hear it for all those people that make this possible. And we had some wonderful rain last night and this morning, and now it's nice for all of us here, and I want to thank the one responsible for that, too. I want to have a round of applause for Scott Brennan, who once again answered our call to be our state Democratic chairman. Scott. Lost eye contact him, but where's Jim Mauer? Where is he anyway? Jim, back here, thank you again for leading our pledge, but thank you for your service in Iraq, and thank you for your future service as a United States Congressman defeating Steve King. Thanks, Jim. Our former state senator, Stacy Apple, is with us. Thank you, Stacy, for your future representing us in the 3rd District. Now I've lost eye contact with Stacy. And I want to recognize and honor all of our Democratic state legislators, including our new Democratic leader in the House, Mark Smith. Mark is here somewhere. I saw him earlier. But I want to especially thank our Senate leader, Mike Gronstall, for being our Rock of Gibraltar during the last session. Where the heck is he? So, Mike, thank you. I just want you all to never forget, those of us who call Iowa home, those of us who care about keeping this state on a progressive course, nothing is more important than winning back the Iowa House, getting more Democrats in the Senate, and winning back the governorship next year for the state of Iowa. And let's salute our fighting 2nd District Congressman Dave Loebsack. I lost now. Where is Dave? I just lost Dave. Now, I want someone to come up here with me right now. Bruce Braley, come here. Folks, You have been so kind and generous to me in all the years I've represented you, both in the House and 30 years in the Senate. I said when I announced my retirement in January that I wasn't going to sit back, that this was going to be a passing the baton, a running passing, because I'm still going to work every day up until that day in January of 2015. But I want you all to know there's only one person I want to pass that baton to, and that's our next United States Senator, Bruce Braley. Thanks, Bruce. Thanks, buddy.
Thank you.
And okay, it's on with the show. You've had your steak. Now it's time for some sizzle. Our first speaker, the mayor of America's seventh largest city. He's new to Iowa, but you've all seen him before. As you know, last summer he was picked by President Obama to be the keynote speaker at our Democratic National Convention in Charlotte. The huge ovation that he got at the end of his speech and all of the talk about him ever since reminded everyone of the ovation for a previous keynote speaker 8 years earlier, an obscure state senator from Illinois named Barack Obama. And the reason that there's been such an ovation and outgoing love and support is because many people see this young man as the future of our party. In fact, if you do this, you can try this at home or on your iPhone, Google Julian Castro and Rising Star, you'll get 410,000 hits. At the convention, Julian was introduced by his identical twin brother, Congressman Joaquin Castro of Texas, whom I introduced earlier, who's also with us here today. As Joaquin said in that introduction, for 18 years, we shared a small room and big dreams in our neighborhood on the west side of San Antonio. Raised by a single mom, they went on together to Stanford University, Harvard Law School. In 2001, at the age of 26, Julian Castro became the youngest elected city councilman in San Antonio's history. He was first elected mayor in 2009, reelected to a third term this year. He's the youngest mayor of a top 50 American city. There's much to admire about Julian Castro, but what has really caught my eye, two things. One is the phrase he used in his speech in Charlotte last summer when he said, "The American dream is not a sprint or a marathon, it's a relay." Think about that. Each generation building up and passing on that opportunity to the next. And the second is what he has just done recently as the mayor. Now, I have been trying for almost 20 years to get something done for early childhood education in America. And this last January, in Barack Obama's State of the Union message, as you know, he committed us to a huge program, a $75 billion program to get every child in America in a good, solid preschool program. Well, we haven't gotten that yet, so the mayor of San Antonio decided not to wait. So he got the business community together. They passed a sales tax measure that's going to go for preschool. And just in August, just last month, the first of San Antonio's children are now enrolling in preschool, and they're going to cover every single kid in San Antonio with preschool education. Folks, so again, let's give a rousing welcome again to one of our bright young leaders, courageous young man, the mayor of San Antonio, Texas, Julian Castro. Julian.
Thank you. Thank you. Hello, Iowa. Great to be here. First of all, let me say a huge thank you on behalf of all of the folks outside of Iowa, and especially from the younger generation of folks, a huge thank you to your great Senator, Tom Harkin, for being a leader, for being a true public servant, and a role model for so many who often wonder whether you can be in public service and still stay true to who you are and be a servant of the people. Tom Harkin has said yes and shown it to all of us over the years. And I know that he couldn't have done half of what he's done without his lovely wife, Ruth, right behind him, leading the way for the Harkin family. Thank you all for having us today. Of course, President Obama some time ago said that the best political decision that he had ever made in his life was to select Joe Biden as Vice President of the United States. And I agree with him. Mr. Vice President, we commend you on your leadership. Thank you for joining us. I didn't have anything to do with the security here. It wasn't me. And, of course, the next great senator from Iowa, Bruce Braley. Well, I know we got a lot of folks from all over Iowa. We got folks from Waterloo here, folks from Ames. We got folks from Dubuque, Des Moines, and, of course, right here in Indianola, Iowa. You know, I come from a city that Google Maps says is about almost exactly 1,000 miles away from here, San Antonio, Texas. It's America's seventh largest city. It's one of the fastest growing cities in the United States, and economically prosperous and vibrant, 1.3 million people. And I've been mayor for about 4 years. And I was telling some folks that a couple of months after I got elected mayor, I had a meeting with a woman in my office at City Hall, and I don't even remember what we were meeting about anymore. And, you know, when you're an elected official, you get a lot of gifts. Most of them are trinkets or T-shirts. I think I have something like 200 T-shirts, and about five of them actually fit me. But before the meeting was over, I was a rookie mayor, and this woman, she gave me this gift bag that was covered with tissue paper, and she said, oh, go ahead and open your gift. And so I took the bag and started unwrapping the tissue paper, and I took the gift out, and it was a prayer card. And the prayer card was of St. Thomas More. Now, I didn't know it, but St. Thomas More is the patron saint of lawyers and politicians. And so, good luck as mayor. And right before she walked out the door, she said, oh, by the way, he was beheaded. That's true. And I thought to myself, what in the world have I gotten myself into? And I know that there are many of y'all in this audience who have been soldiering away in the trenches in Iowa as Democrats for a long time. There are probably some folks here who were at the first steak fry. Folks who have been block walking and phone banking and emailing and Facebooking and letter writing, because we still do that sometimes. And you sometimes wonder, why in the world are we doing this? We gather here today at a very special moment in 2013, a moment when our world is changing at a faster rate than it's ever changed in human history. A time when it's easier to travel than it ever has been. It's easier to communicate with folks than ever before. Computing in an iPhone is faster than a computer that cost millions and millions of dollars just a few years ago. The United States is engaged in a 21st century global economy that is more competitive than it ever has been, with countries around the world who are producing well-educated young people capable of learning and manipulating the new technologies that will define this century, and a time in which brain power is the new currency of success in this 21st century. It's a time when the divisions that have often separated us, of geography, of creed, are crumbling at a faster rate than at any other time in human history. And the question before us is, what is the blueprint in this world for this century? What is the blueprint that America should follow to ensure prosperity in the years to come? Our friends across the other side of the aisle say that the blueprint is this, that if everybody will just go on their own, we'll all be fine. If everybody will just do their own thing and government leaves everybody alone, everything will be great. But I believe in a different blueprint. I believe in the blueprint of Roosevelt investing in the GI Bill so that millions of Americans could get a great higher education. I believe in the blueprint of Johnson shepherding Medicare through Congress so that millions and millions of senior citizens could get the health care they needed. And I believe in the blueprint of President Obama and Vice President Biden extending health care to all Americans in the United States. And I know that this is the blueprint because it's worked like this. In the United States, we have always had a basic bargain. We expect you and your family to work hard, but when you do, we reward that hard work with opportunity. I know that in more than just words. I know that from my own life. At the convention, I spoke about my grandmother, Victoria. My grandmother came over to the United States as a 6-year-old orphan from Mexico. She dropped out in elementary school, and eventually, because of that, she ended up working as a maid, a cook, and a babysitter her whole life. And I and my brother grew up with my grandmother and my mother. And I remember on April 3rd, 1992, Joaquin and I got 2 packets in the mail. And these packets were from Stanford University. They had gone through the public schools of San Antonio and said, you know what, we're going to try and apply to the best schools in the United States. And on April 3rd of 92, we got that acceptance letter. And then a couple of weeks later, we actually got the bill. And it cost $27,000 per person to be able to attend Stanford University. And my mother was making less than $20,000 that year. And my grandmother was getting a few hundred dollars in a Social Security check. And here were these two women, both of whom had worked very, very hard during their life, watching their sons and grandson with this enormous opportunity and wondering how in the world they would be able to pay for it. And I can tell you this, the only reason that I was able to reach my American dream, to go to college and become a professional, was because I worked hard and my family worked hard, but because there were Pell Grants and Perkins loans and work study and Stafford loans. In other words, because I invested in myself. But fundamentally, I reached my dream because you invested in me, because the American people invested in me. That is America. That's what's great about this nation. That is the blueprint for its success in this 21st century. We know that in San Antonio. Last November, for the first time ever, the voters said yes to an educational initiative. 22,400 four-year-olds in San Antonio will now get a high-quality, full-day pre-K education so that we have the best prepared, best educated, most likely to succeed kids in all of the state of Texas. You know, my grandmother, when I was young, she used to tell me stories about when she was a girl. And she told me that after she was pulled out of school, that she used to go work the fields with her family. Now, this is the first time that I've really been in Iowa. I got to admit, I lost at Keno for 5 minutes a few years ago in Council Bluffs. But this is really the first time that I've been in Iowa. And when we were coming in on the plane, I looked out the window onto Iowa, and I saw all of the fields, the green space. And I thought how proud she would have been that she had been picking crops and her grandson would be here where you guys pick a president of the United States. That is the American dream. And so we have the blueprint. We know what we have to do. We need to continue to elect great leaders like President Obama and Vice President Biden. And, of course, Congressman, soon to be Senator, Bruce Braley. And keep working and keep phone banking and keep block walking. And I look forward to election night on November 2016. I'll be in San Antonio. I'll probably have the TV on. I'm sure you guys will be at some election night victory party somewhere. I look forward to watching CNN and CBS and MSNBC and ABC. And I look forward to the moment when Brett Hume on Fox News turns to Brett Baer and says, Brett, we're calling Iowa's electoral votes for the next president of the United States, the Democratic nominee for president. Thank you all very much.
That was great. Thank you, Julian. Now, just remain standing for a second. Tomorrow, momentous day tomorrow, is Julian and Joaquin's birthday. So we're going to give them an advance happy birthday. We ready? Happy birthday to you.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Castro. Happy birthday to you.
We are truly honored to have as our keynote speaker the Vice President of the United States. I remind you, I'm sure I needn't remind you that Joe Biden first ran for president here in 1987 and 1988. He spent so much time in Iowa. He has friends all over this state. I'm pretty sure he's an Iowan at heart. And he's one of the few people outside the state that can honestly say he's been to every one of our 99 counties more than once. More than once. So he doesn't really need an introduction, but there are a few things I want to say about my great friend. For years, Joe was a powerful senator. Now he's the second most powerful person in the world. But he's the same decent, unpretentious, approachable Joe who was elected to the Senate in 1972 at the ridiculously young age of 29. All the years he served in the Senate, very seldom did you see him after hours in the Washington social swirl. As Ruth said, when the Senate quit work for the day, he was over at Union Station, got on the train, hour and half ride back to Wilmington, Delaware, to spend the evening with his family. And that has meant a lot to Ruth and me, because this job pulls you in a lot of directions, and there's always demands on your time. There's always demands to do something in the evening. And Le Petit General one time, and when we started having our family, laid the rule down, no more than two nights a week out, and we abided by that. And yet here was Joe Biden every night, got on that train, went back to his family. To me, that says more about a person than just about anything else you can say, about what he cared about most of all. And never lost touch with his humble roots. He's always been a fighter for working people. He understands, as I said one time, in the marrow of his bones, what it means to be middle class. As we all know, Joe has known tragedy in his own life. And I can tell you, his eyes and his heart are always open to the struggles of others. And during his 36 years in the Senate, there was always one place to find Joe Biden, at the center of the action. He chaired the Judiciary Committee during some of the most contentious Supreme Court confirmation hearings, Robert Bork, Clarence Thomas. He chaired the Foreign Relations Committee at a transformational time in our U.S. foreign policy following the attacks of 9/11. He also made his mark on criminal justice issues, including the landmark 1994 crime bill and the Violence Against Women Act, Joe Biden's bill. And understand this. Last year, to his great credit and our country's, he led our party and our country in recognizing the justice of marriage equality for all Americans. Joe Biden. So we all know why Joe Biden is so popular here in Iowa, wherever he goes. He's the real deal. President Obama calls him America's happy warrior. He's smart, witty, tireless, irreverent. Did I mention irreverent? And those of us who know and love Joe so much, we always say we know he's also unsilenceable. And in this case, that's a good thing. So, my friends, I just wish I could put into words, and I really can, but I just wish I could put into words what Joe Biden has meant to me in my years in coming to the House and then to the Senate and having him as one of my mentors and guiding me and instilling in me just his values, the great values he always had, of understanding why we're there. Why we're there, not for our own glory, not to make the comfortable, but to help those that need a government so that they too can have what Julian Castro said, the opportunities for advancement and growth in America. I just, as I said many times, I always want to refer to the Vice President with all due respect as Mr. Vice President. But I got to tell you, it's hard for me not to just call him my good friend, Joe Biden. Hello, folks. Good to be back in Iowa. How are you? With so many good friends, it's great to be with you all. Great to be here with Tom and Ruth and all of you. And let me start by saying to Jimmy Maurer, Jim, my son Bo, sends his love, support, and affection. And Bo and Jim served in Iraq for a year. And I want you continue to do what you did for our administration, old buddy, and taking care of vets and their families won't be forgotten. And I look forward to coming over and visiting you in your office, man. And, folks, I know the mayor will find this as a shock, but it's amazing when you come to speak at the steak fry, a whole lot of people seem to take notice. I don't know why the hell that is. You've attracted the entire National Press Corps here. And I've never quite understood it, but I'm learning. Look, folks, when the mayor was talking about Tom, he mentioned St. Thomas More, and he was talking about how he didn't realize
Tommy Moore was, we Catholics refer to it as the patron saint of lawyers and judges and public officials. And, you know, I don't want to turn this into a mutual admiration society. You know Tom as well as I do. But I know Tom and Ruth really very well. And when he made that reference, it reminded me of a, there's a play about that period when Thomas More was taking on Henry VIII and refusing to change the law so that he could get married, remarried, divorce his wife and remarried. And there was a famous scene in that play, A Man for All Seasons, where his son-in-law was a fellow named Roper. And Roper came over, it turns out, at the urging of the king's men to try to get More to compromise and overlook the law. And there's a famous exchange, and it reminds me, and it will remind you, of Tom. He said, in responding to Roper, he said, "Roper, and if I cut down all the laws in England to do that, what will you do when the devil turns round on you then, Roper? All the laws being flat." These are God's laws, not man's. And he went on to point out, you have to stand sometimes in spite of inordinate pressure. That's what I've watched Tom do. And I mean this, it's not hyperbole. You've seen it too. I've served with a lot of great women and men in my career in the Senate. But none with a conscience, none with a North Star, none with more certitude about why he ran for office in the first place than Tom. And let me tell you, Tom's work is obvious. Everybody knows about his work with Americans with Disabilities, the Americans with Disabilities Act. But the thing that people don't realize, and Tom and Ruth and I were talking about it on the way over, as I said it earlier. First of all, few men or women ever get to see the fruits of their labor, especially when, in fact, that labor was in the face of overwhelming opposition. Overwhelming opposition. Tom took on the business community. Tom took on the opposite party. Tom took on everyone. But not only did Tom change the lives, literally, of millions and millions of Americans with disabilities, in the same way with his IDEA program in schools that educate children to the degree to which they're educable. Not only did he change, but here's what he did. He did something remarkable. We don't think of it. He changed all America. He turned able people into either not looking at the disabled at all or looking at them with nothing but sympathy and pity, to having them look at them as equals, having them look at them in a way to value all that they had to offer. Tom, you've not only changed the state of affairs for the disabled in America, you changed America's soul. Think how different it is from what it was 25 years ago. What people look for, abled or disabled, is to be treated with dignity, treated with respect. That's what Tom changed. I can't think of a handful of people, and I've served, as I've been told, it's supposed to make me feel good, it made me feel bad, longer than all but 13 people in American history. I've served longer in the Senate. And so, it's astounding. But Tom doesn't leave it to just what happened here at home. Think of what Tom has done and how loud his voice has been for those around the world, not only the disabled, but the persecuted, not only the disabled, but the people who, in fact, have no voice. Tom has never been afraid to speak out. From the war in Vietnam to the death squads in Central America to the outrages of everything from genital mutilation of young women in Africa to what's going on in Syria. Tom's voice has had a profound impact on how we view ourselves. And today, Tom remains the conscience of the Senate. Tom does not allow anyone the comfort in the Democratic caucus, and I mean this sincerely, the comfort of denial. Tom does not permit, because of his voice, the willing suspension of disbelief that so many of us would rather engage in, because darn, these problems are hard. To recognize them, to acknowledge them, places a burden on us. The good news is we have Tom for another full year. Another full year. And the good news, and I've gotten to know Bruce and Carolyn well. We've campaigned. I campaigned with him. He won in spite of me in 06. 08 and 10, I think I've been in every one of your campaigns. I've got to see him. I've got to see him up close and personal. And I've got to see the same thing that impressed his constituency. In 06, it wasn't a certain thing. But I watch people react to him, like you watch how people react to us when we speak, because a lot, you've been engaged in politics. You can feel it. You can taste it. Right? Well, the thing I observed about how people responded is the same reason why Tom admires him and why I think he's going to be a great senator. He's absolutely authentic. There's not a phony bone in his body. I told Bruce I'd come campaign for him or against him, whichever would help him the most. Folks, look, when the president knew I was coming, he wanted me to, and I mean this sincerely, I spend 4 to 6 hours a day with him. We become very close friends. I'm with him a lot. He's a hell of a man. And he wanted me to thank you. No, seriously. He knew I was coming, and he asked me whether I'd thank you. Thank you what you did for him personally, but also thank you for delivering Iowa for us in 2008 and again in 2012. Jill and Michelle and Barack and I, we would not be standing where we are were it not for all of you assembled in front of us today. You're the heart and soul of this party, and this has been a key to our ability to govern. From that day in August of 2008, when the ticket was announced, the President and I have had a laser focus on one thing, raising up the middle class. The middle class has been battered, as you all know, been battered not just in the 8 years that preceded us, but really the decline began much earlier. I don't know how many times I've walked a picket line. I don't know how many times I've been with you in your hometowns as factories were being padlocked and jobs were being sent overseas. And watching people who have had the ability to raise their family, the decent income, watch it all evaporate before them. So we concluded, and this, I'm not being absolutely literal with you. One thing I've learned, Mr. Mayor, no one ever doubts I mean what I say. The problem is I usually say all that I mean. But literally, and they kid me for using literally often, and I do. But folks, literally, the president and I had a handshake when he asked me to join him. I asked him only one question. Was he committed, as he says he was, to rebuilding the middle class? And I also told him there's two things I would not do as vice president. I wouldn't wear any funny hats, and I wouldn't change my brand. And I've kept my promise, but he's kept his. He's kept his. And ladies and gentlemen, let me tell you how we will measure the successive failure of our successive administration. It won't be whether or not the GDP continues to grow, and it is growing. It won't be whether or not the stock market has returned and exceeded its high, which it has. It will not be whether or not we create just any old job. The measure of our success, and this is absolutely the commitment we made to one another, the measure of the success of our administration will be whether or not the middle class is growing, and the things that allow it to grow and allow it to feel some security are able to be put in place again. Providing real economic security and peace of mind. Creating real jobs. Jobs you could raise a middle-class family on. Jobs. Jobs that are the jobs that have built this country. Unlike any other country in the world, we are uniquely a product of having the largest middle class in the world. For when the middle class does well, the wealthy do very well, and the poor have an opportunity. The president believes and has demonstrated that you grow the economy as we always have, from the middle out, not from the top down. And he's acted on that belief. The president of the United States and I, along with all of you, understand, you've heard me say it a number of times, and I'll keep saying it. Middle class is not a number. It's not $50,250 or $49,000. It is a value set. The middle class in America is about being able to own your own home, not rent it. Keep your farm, not have to sell it. About being able to live in a safe and decent neighborhood, to send your kid to a school that if they do well, they have a chance of being admitted to college. And if they get into college, like Barack, like me, like Michelle, like the mayor, like his brother, like Jill, having an equal chance to get there, not based on your income, but based on the fact you earned it and you worked for it and you have a chance. That's been the American story. Is brought home time and again by Joaquin and every succeeding generation, but is the story of the history of the progress of this country. It's about being able to be lucky enough to put a little money aside so maybe your children will not have to take care of you like you've had to take care of your elderly parents. It's all about the opportunity to be able to find a decent job because your government has fought on your behalf, not gotten in your way. My dad used to have an expression. We all have our stories, and I know so many of you personally. Your story is no different than mine, or quite frankly, in a fundamental way, no different than the mayor's. What's it all about? I'll never forget, everybody. I always ask me why, by the way, the president has made everyone in Delaware very upset because he talks about me as the guy from Scranton all the time. I am from Scranton. I'm proud of it. But I represented Delaware for 36 years. He makes me sound like I was a kid who climbed out of the coal mines with a lunch bucket in my hand. It wasn't that. My life wasn't a whole lot different than yours. But when my dad, after the war, in the early 50s, when there were no good jobs in Scranton, I remember my dad coming up and sitting down, and you've had this story, you've seen it. My dad's sitting on the edge of the bed in my grandpa's house where we were living and saying, Joe, Dad's going to move. I'll be gone for about a year. I'm moving down to Wilmington, Delaware. And Uncle Frank, there's jobs down there, honey. And when I get a job and get us all set up, I'm going to come back. And I'll bring you and Mom and Val and Jimmy. It's only 157 miles, honey, and I'll be home most weekends. I remember thinking at the time, it's kind of lousy, but my dad was absolutely certain it was going to be okay, so we believed it was going to be okay. But from that moment on, as we were raised in Claymont, Delaware, and Wilmington, Delaware, every time we learn of somebody losing a job during a recession or losing a job for whatever reason, when the steel mill closed and shut down in Claymont, my dad used to say, and all my siblings can repeat it, they've heard it 100 times, he said, Joey, a job's about a lot more than a paycheck. It's about your dignity. It's about respect. It's about your place in the community. It's about being able to hold your head up. It's about being able to take care of your family. Well, ladies and gentlemen, what Barack set out to do is deal with all those things legitimately in the government's power that could make it possible, that enhances the ability to enhance the life of middle-class people. It was pretty straightforward stuff. What are the things that fundamentally affect the lives of the middle class, causing them to fall out of the middle class? Cost of health care. That's why the first thing he did, a remarkable accomplishment, something that Teddy Roosevelt started talking about but took Barack Obama to do, with the great help of Tom, and I'm not being solicitous, for real, he passed the Affordable Care Act. So now, he decided instead of seeing all those factories padlocked, he wanted to see a lot more open. And the first thing he did was insist upon free trade, began to fight on behalf of American workers, began to say to our opposition, our competition, all right, we'll compete. We can beat you on any grounds as long as it's fair trade. But if it is not, we will intervene. And he has, more than any president of the United States of America. And in the process, he's generated $2.2 trillion in exports last year, creating good jobs in the process. Manufacturing jobs brought back to the United States of America, 500,000 of them, 500,000 since he took office. Investing in community colleges, because there are 600,000 good-paying manufacturing jobs in American high-tech industries for which there are not trained people. So in combination with major businesses, he invested $2 billion in community colleges, creating a conveyor belt from community colleges at decent-paying jobs. Ladies and gentlemen, over the objection of almost everyone, he rescued the automobile industry, putting his presidency on the line, saving 1 million jobs, and creating 300,000 new jobs since then. Energy costs. Reducing the cost of energy for middle-class families, doubling those mileage standards of automobiles, which will save $1.7 trillion at the gas pump over the next 10 years and over 12 billion barrels of imported oil. Ladies and gentlemen, we're now the world's leading producer of oil and natural gas, and we have a 100-year supply of natural gas. But at the same time, he's doubled renewable energy in this country and is committed to going further. Ladies and gentlemen, I'll not take the time, but college affordability. We've increased the number of Pell Grants, Mr. Mayor, by 3 million since we've taken office. Over 9 million middle-class families were able to keep their kids in college because of a $2,500 tax credit. We've increased the eligibility. Ladies and gentlemen, we've also made sure that that the interest rates in student loans will not double, and the student will never have to pay back more than 10% of his income after he graduates, so he'll be able to make it. Ladies and gentlemen, and in spite of our Republican friends, this is all done at the same time we reduce taxes for the average middle-class family by $3,600. We've cut business taxes 18 times. We reduced the deficit that we inherited by 50% since 2008, the largest reduction in history since World War II. Ladies and gentlemen, this president and his leadership has reduced the national debt over the next 10 years by $2.5 trillion. And in the process, we've created 7.5 million new jobs. But folks, there's a lot more we have to do. A lot more we have to do. But there is not a single reason in the world we can't meet our objective of having the most educated population in the world, a higher percentage of college graduates than any nation in the world by 2020. There's not a single reason why we can't generate 100,000 new STEM teachers in the next 10 years, why we can't cut imports of oil in half by 2020, why we can't achieve energy independence, why we can't generate, as we promised, 1 million new manufacturing jobs in the next 4 years. And the list goes on. One of the things that I resent about the Republican Party is they continue, almost like they want to talk down America's prospects. Ladies and gentlemen, we're on the verge of a fundamental change in this country. Like I said, a job is about dignity. It's all about dignity and the standard of living, and you need a decent job to be able to provide that. And by the way, it goes beyond a job. It goes beyond how we treat the people in our country. I know not a lot of you, but a lot of people criticize me for speaking out not long ago about gay marriage. I could not remain silent anymore. It's time we stop talking. It's the civil rights of our day. It's the issue of our day. It's the reason why the president believes we've got to take 11 million people out of the shadows and give them the opportunity, earn their way to citizenship, treat them with dignity. That's what strengthened this country all along. That's why the president eliminated DOMA, Don't Ask, Don't Tell. That's why he came out against this notion that somehow marriage cannot be recognized in one state and denied in another. Ladies and gentlemen, and when it comes to the rights of, you know, the president's phrase, and I'll paraphrase it slightly, that everybody in America should have the dignity to choose who they love and marry who they choose. He believes that, but not just because it's a human right, because it's all about treating everyone with dignity. Ladies and gentlemen, look, when it comes to women, it's not just about choice and equal pay for Barack and me and for many of you. I am absolutely determined, the president is absolutely determined, that my daughter and my four granddaughters will have every single solitary opportunity my sons and my grandsons have without any exception. None. Zero. Not a single solitary exception. It's about human dignity. It's about taking advantage of all that this country has to offer. Look, and the thing Barack and I have been saying for the last 4 years, the American people are way ahead of their leaders. You notice, when we announced our position on gay marriage, it wasn't a surprise. The American people agreed with us. When we announced our position in immigration, it wasn't a surprise. The American people agree with us. Our Republican colleagues have to figure out the American people are always ahead of their leadership. And it's time. It's time. Ladies and gentlemen, it's always been the story, the history, the journey of this country that the American people have been ahead. And I know I've been criticized for saying this, but I'll say it again. That's what makes America exceptional. That's what makes us exceptional. In the area of foreign policy, the President and I were determined from the outset to reestablish that notion of a shining city on a hill, where we were once again the most respected nation in the world, where we once again looked to, not just for the example of our power, but for the power of our example. That's why. That's why the world has repaired to America for so long. We told you at this steak fry in 2007, at opposite ends of the platform, but he and I said the exact same thing, coincidentally. We said the first order of business, if either of us were elected, would be to end the war in Iraq. And we did. We ended the war in Iraq. The President gave me the responsibility of coordinating that effort to end the war. And the proudest moment as Vice President was standing in the Afua Palace, a god-awful, gaudy palace of Saddam Hussein, before American troops and Iraqi troops, and having the great honor of dismissing American troops and saying, like every American troop before you, you're going home with nothing in hand but the certain knowledge that you did your job and you're coming home. Ladies and gentlemen, we promised you we would end the war in Afghanistan, and I guarantee you we will end the war in Afghanistan. But what Barack and I have believed from the outset, everybody says, why do you guys, you know, why has it gotten on? Why have you become such good friends? I have great respect for everyone with whom I ran in 2007. But if you go back and look at those 13 debates, the only two people that never disagreed on a single solitary subject in those debates were Barack Obama and Joe Biden. And the reason I tell you that is this. This has been seamless. It's been an honor, a great honor, to work for him, work under him, work with him. Because from the outset in foreign policy, he was determined, as I was, that the best way to defend our national interest was working in concert with the international community, not at odds with it. Obviously, every president reserved the right to act alone if American interests are at stake. But we know, he knows, we are much stronger when we act in concert with our allies in the international community. And that's exactly how he has stepped up to deal with the atrocities of occurring in Syria, with the fundamental violation of human rights by the use of gas for the first time without the world responding since early on in the at the end of World War I. Others have used it, but he wasn't going to allow it to happen on his watch. And yesterday, as the President said, the use of chemical weapons anywhere in the world is an affront to human dignity and the threat to security of people everywhere. And let me note parenthetically that I think John Kerry has been one of the best secretaries of state so far in the history of the United States of America. Because the President charged him. When the President went to the G8 after a long discussion that's happened before he got in the helicopter, he's the one who raised with Putin, why don't we jointly, since it's not in either of our interests to allow this largest stockpile in the world to go unattended, why don't we jointly move to the United Nations and jointly secure it and destroy it? A lot of cynics were of the view that Putin would not respond. But he did respond, not because he's a good guy, because it's the naked self-interest of Russia to see these weapons not fall in anyone's hands. So as a consequence of the incredible work of John Kerry, with his counterpart, the foreign minister of Russia, we're going to the United Nations with a resolution this week that will, in fact, call on the United Nations and the world to put pressure on Syria to have the confiscation and destruction of all those weapons. And ladies and gentlemen, as the President said, while we've made important progress, much work remains to be done. The United States will continue working with Russia, the United Kingdom, France, the United Nations, to ensure this process is verifiable and there are consequences should Assad regime not comply with the framework agreed to. Ladies and gentlemen, the President's vision is absolutely clear, is absolutely straightforward. He, in fact, is the reason why the world community is facing up finally, to this hideous prospect of the largest stockpile in the world of chemical weapons being confiscated and destroyed. And ladies and gentlemen, we have a clear vision for America. It rests on a growing and prosperous middle class where the playing field is level, where the middle class has a fighting chance, and where, again, we lead the world by the power of our example, ending torture, ending the war, refusing to yield to the baser side of human nature. I'm absolutely convinced. I say to Tom, he and I came into politics about the same time. When I got elected as a 29-year-old kid, I was referred to as the young idealist. And if you notice, even to this day, even though I'm the old guy in the White House, whenever they talk about me as the White House optimist. I am an optimist. I'm more optimistic about America's chances today than I was when I arrived as a 29-year-old kid. There is not a single reason in the world why we will not lead the world in the 21st century. And the reason for that is really simple, folks. Whenever the American people have been given a half a chance, they have never, 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 ever let their country down. And that's what my president's about, making sure the American people have an even chance. Ladies and gentlemen, as I told the president of China, who I know well, Mr. Xi, as I told Mr. Putin when I last had a conversation with him, it's never, 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 ever been a good bet to bet against the American people. God bless you all. God bless our president. And may God protect our troops. Thank you.